Welcome. We want to welcome you to this session. This is number 255, Embracing a Trilogy of Soulmates by Michael Farnsworth. Before we begin, I'd like to remind you all to please turn off anything that makes noise on your wrist or in your pockets. And if you're feeling generous today, please make a donation to the Sunstone Giving Tree. You can buy an ornament and put it on a tree, and then you get to wear a little sunbeam pin, and you get to feel really good about yourself for the rest of the day. So, Michael Farnsworth is a retired faculty member from the Department of Family. He taught at Ricks College in Rexburg, Idaho, for 31 years. Michael is husband to Cindy, father to Brandon, Cammy, and Jeffrey, and grandfather to Joel, and his good family is here supporting him today. His education, he has a doctorate in educational psychology from BYU, and even a more important education, perhaps, he and Cindy have been married for 34 years. Michael.
I was hoping Lucinda would say, make a small donation to the speaker, but... First off, thanks for coming. I was starting to think my family would be the only people to show. There has only been one time in my life that I have clapped during a general conference talk. It was a number of years ago. I was standing in our kitchen listening to D. Todd Christofferson talk about the union necessary in true Christian living. The one line I clapped for was simple. Becoming one within ourselves prepares us for the greater blessing of becoming one with God and Christ. Here, for the first time that I was aware of, a church leader addressed the Eastern notion of becoming whole and having union with ourselves as a necessary prerequisite to becoming one with God. In this paper, I will explore the idea of embracing three different levels of soulmates, inner, marital, and divine. Since each level impacts the other, I believe the first level is arguably the most important. If we do not achieve a wholeness within ourselves, we will remain as a house divided. A house divided against itself cannot stand. We will be unable to embrace another in wholeness, and we certainly will not be able to embrace God. I believe it is very significant that in both Hebrew and Greek language, the word perfect means wholeness and completeness. Embracing the inner self is a metaphorical spiritual journey fraught with dark caves, fiery dragons, and inner confrontations. Much has been written about this metaphorical journey into the depths of our soul, but we live in such a mechanistic, appearance-oriented culture that too many of us get lost in the maze of social expectations. Our inner metaphorical journey is postponed and sometimes never taken. This is an unfortunate consequence of living in our modern world. It is regrettable never to have entered into the exploration of our own inner terrain. Robert Johnson explains the reason for the distressing non-occurrence of this inner journey. He makes this unfortunate observation about religion. Quote, "Much of our religious heritage is a map or set of instruction for the deepest meaning of our interior life, not a set of laws for outer conduct. To relate to our religious teachings only in its literal outer dimension is to lose its inner spiritual meanings. This dimension of materialism is far more harmful than much of what is usually condemned under that dark name." Close quote. In other words, when we read the scriptures and interpret them in such a way as to think Christ was only referring to the outer world of conduct and culture and not to the inner world of our souls, we miss the proverbial boat. The Pharisees were good examples of taking care of all the obligations to the outer kingdom. They lived the commandments and law with exactness while ignoring the inner kingdom of their souls. In consequence, Christ called them whited sepulchres full of dead men's bones. Okay, for the duration, I'm going to leave my paper reading it. It's too long. It would be too boring. I'm just going to talk to you about the ideas. And with those ideas, I hope, if I do my job, I will trigger in you thoughts, feelings that I hope you pay attention to. Because I'm not asking you to agree with anything that I say here this afternoon, but I am asking an effort to understand and interpret the consequences of the thoughts and feelings in relationship to your own experience in your own life. When people have asked me, what are you going to talk about? I've given them the explanation, well, it's this mating, this embracing of soulmate on an individual level, on a marital level, on a divine level. And as I thought about that, my response to that, it's like, yeah, I don't think so. It's really more about falling in love with the self, falling in love with the marital companion that you've chosen, and falling in love with the divine. And I'm not talking about the cheap kind of romantic falling in love that often occurs in this culture that masquerades as love. I'm talking about it is an ordeal. It is a challenge. It is tough. It's tough to go through the inner introspection and confrontation. It's tough to be married. It's a long ordeal. And the same thing can be said for, I believe, the divine. So I'm going to start with a little illustration. And I'm also going to suggest that during the course of this, I want it to be a dialogue too. I've got basically four sections. At the end of each section, I will want to see if there's any questions. And when you ask the question, I'm going to ask you to come up and use this microphone, because that microphone, even though the recorder will pick it up, a lot of times people in the back don't hear what the question is. From this illustration, this circle, and the line dividing the top third, this part up here is our ego. And our ego loves to think that it is the center of the show. It likes to think it's down here. But in reality, it's up here, and there's a very small part of our consciousness that it is the director of. And the ego loathes, hates, to have anything show up that would indicate that it's not the center. It really does believe it calls all the shots, even though it has a lot of experience indicating otherwise. It doesn't pay attention to that stuff. For the purposes of this discussion, I'm going to use Carl Jung's psychology. He talks about the ego as the conscious part of trying to establish and fit into whatever major culture we grow up in. Doesn't make any difference what the language is, what the culture is. It's going to try to fit in. It's going to try to be good. It's going to try to achieve prominence. The ego loves to think of itself as special and grandiose. Just can't help itself. Besides the ego, Jung talks about masculine energy, which he labels as the animus, and feminine energy, which he labels as the anima. And these energies are innate within us. But the culture that we are born into will either bring out one aspect of the energies while ignoring the other energies, depending on, once again, the values of the culture. So what happens is that males growing up in this culture, we get our energies, masculine energies, triggered, but our feminine energies are suppressed. They're ignored. In fact, we get shamed for them, and we're embarrassed about them. Females have their feminine energies triggered, and their masculine energies get suppressed because they get in trouble for, you know, demonstrating some of that stuff. Besides the ego, besides the masculine, feminine energies, there's another aspect which I think is critically important, which is really at the center of this paper today, and that's the shadow. And the shadow is the dark side of our personality. It's the underbelly. It's the part of us that we do not want to acknowledge, and we hate to have other people see it. So we go to great extent, our ego goes to great extent to make sure it's covered up, it's taken care of, it's packaged in such a way that nobody knows about it. And even if we're alone, if that energy flips and it becomes really apparent, We can pretend like it never happened because nobody saw us. And we can pretend like we've got it under control. Just stay with the same program. We're going to talk quite a bit about the shadow, because the shadow part is the part that we project upon other people. We blame it on other people because we don't want to accept it and own it ourselves. The last part of the self that Jung talks about is the self with a capital S. He believes that the self is divine. And for the purposes of the little illustration, that blue part in the middle, I'm going to suggest, is the divine self. It represents the unconscious energies that we're born into the world with and that kind of get messed with growing up as children. So, with that as a basis, besides talking about the shadow, I'm going to also spend quite a bit of time talking about the masculine, feminine energies that need balanced in our own soul, individually, in our marriages, and with the divine. The lyricist Bruce Cockburn talks about, I think, he says this. He says, "I've always liked the notion of balance, even though I've never lived it." And I think most of us can agree with some of the things that are talked about. The masculine and feminine energies. It makes sense, yeah. I like the idea. But being able to pull it off in our own life may be a completely different thing. So what happens then is the projection of our shadow upon other people. If you want to find out something about your shadow, if you just take a minute and think about what irritates you most in other people, what are your pet peeves? What really sets you off? What really gets your goat? What really pisses you off about these people? All you have to do is understand that that is a pretty good mirror for what's going on in you. And the reason that it's so irritating other people because you have not accepted it in yourself. If you had accepted it in yourself, it wouldn't carry the energy. But the fact is, those things that we reject in ourselves, we find it very easy to project on other people. I need to talk to you about what I call sanctuary trauma. Sanctuary trauma is what happens to us as children, when we're children. Now, those people that are abused and know that they were abused, they don't need to be told. They know what's going on. In fact, they get abused more by saying that, well, that's really no big deal. What happened to you? Why don't you get over it? Why don't you forgive them? The rest of us, me as an example, I thought I grew up in a wonderful LDS family. I grew up in a small town in Idaho. I was the third born. I should have been the lost middle child, but because my older brother defaulted in the hero role, I volunteered to be the hero in the family. I did all the right stuff. If you would have told me up until probably I was mid-30s that I'd been traumatized in my childhood, I'd say, I don't think so. I had a very good childhood. Thank you very much. And those thoughts never even entered my mind, never even entered my heart until I started to become more educated, until I started to read some books by Alice Miller. The Drama of the Gifted Child is a great one. Another one by Robert Firestone, entitled The Compassionate Child Rearing, is another wonderful one, which will open up our hearts and our minds to the fact that some of the stuff that occurred to us as children maybe did have an impact. And sanctuary refers to sacred places. So what I'm going to suggest to us is our hearts, as children, we were driven out of. We could not stay there because we had to meet the expectations of whoever was around, parents specifically. So if we listed a continuum up here from abuse to neglect, I'm going to suggest to you that in many ways we were sexually neglected because nobody talked to us about our bodies, nobody labeled them. If we did get a lesson, it was typically a one-night stand. And then we were just shamed and whatever else that occurred with our parents as they struggled and were embarrassed in talking about it. The idea of sanctuary trauma is simply that maybe we were spiritually neglected. We talk so much in the church about
how you know when the Spirit is communicating to you. It communicates in a small, still voice. And you have to listen for it. Who, as a parent, teaches their children to listen to what's going on inside of them? Versus, you do what I tell you to do, and you do it now. Or you're going to get in trouble. And it could be physical trouble, it could be emotional trouble, it could be any kind of trouble. But we learn very early to start hiding. And that hiding is the spiritual neglect that leads to sanctuary trauma. We start living outside of ourselves. So little children, as they start to grow, start to do the song and dance routine for everybody else. And we carry that into, adolescence. We carry it into our adulthood. So I think it's really fascinating to see adults that are 50 plus, my age, my peers, and I look at them and all I still see is a little boy trying so hard to be so good, to be important, to be accepted in whatever context they may find themselves in, whether it's business, whether it's religion, or whatever else. I think that's fascinating. So the sanctuary trauma, I think, is a very real issue and provides the foundation, I think, for what's going on. Another concept I want to introduce is old brain, new brain. When we were born, what is represented in the old brain basically is our survival brain. It's the brain, part of ourselves, that is oriented towards survival. Nobody had to teach us how to breathe. Nobody had to teach our liver how to function. Nobody had to teach our heart how to. Nobody needed to teach us how to digest food. All of that became part of just the part and package of the old brain. And the old brain is also responsible for, in large extent, what people refer to as their emotions, which I refer to as your energies. We have all these energies boiling around inside of us, and in large part, that's the nature and part of our shadow. That these energies become very kind of scary, and they're overwhelming, and they can take on a lot of different forms, and you know, what do we do it? It's gonna
bring in some miscellaneous pieces, fragmented pieces, and then hopefully put them all together by the time we get done. I want to talk about the shadow just for a minute, this other component. Two stories. One story is about a man who was a cleaner in one of the temples. And one of the rooms he was in, he was up on a ladder and he was cleaning the glass. And it was kind of semi-light, semi-dark. And because he didn't have the light on in the room, but some others were there. As he was cleaning, he thought he saw out of his peripheral vision somebody standing in the air right behind him. And it scared him so much he turned around and he just about fell off the ladder. And then it hit him. All he saw was his own reflection. And that reflection scared him. And that's the nature of the shadow. Sometimes we see glimpses of ourselves that it's like, oh, man, is that really me? Could I really? And it's kind of scary. The other is a story from Rachel Remen. And I don't know if it's her book, Kitchen Table Wisdom, or My Grandfather's Blessings. But she was a young child, I don't know, 3 or 4, I don't know. Her family was putting together a puzzle. And she did not like the little dark pieces of the puzzle because it reminded her of spiders and it scared her. And she would take the pieces and hide them under a cushion. Well, the family got so far in putting together the puzzle, they couldn't go any further. And they were asking, well, where are all these? And they discovered that she had deposited all these scary pieces under the cushion. And so it is with us. We get these shadow pieces going on and they're scary. And so we start hiding them, hiding from ourselves and hiding from other people. The last thing for this opening section probably has to do with the balance of energies. If I am a typical male in this culture, I am going to focus and become obsessive about how I act as a man. Anything feminine is going to challenge me and is going to threaten me, and I'm not going to like it. In fact, I will be drawn to women who will act those energies that I cannot act. So if I cannot be vulnerable, if I cannot be soft, I will want a woman who will act that way. And I will need her to act that way because she cannot be strong because that challenges my masculinity. I'm going to ask, She's going to need to be weak and passive and not have a voice so I can feel like a real man. Same is true of a woman. If she has ignored those masculine energies, she is just going to be weak and she's going to need a man to take care of her and she's not going to be able to make decisions for herself and she won't find her voice and all this other stuff. So that kind of stuff goes together. So with that as an introduction, let me tell you the story that I believe illustrates this notion of embracing the inner self, and I'll use my own experience. Growing up in the LDS family in a small town in Idaho, once again, I thought I was a wonderful family. I thought I was wonderful because I was the hero child. I became very popular. I became very successful in sports, high school politics. I was had my share of notary in the, you know, the neighborhood paper. I went away to college at Ricks College for a year. I went on a mission, successful there. I came back and went to the Ricks College again, went down to BYU, met Cindy. We got married, and I got a job at teaching at Ricks College when I was 24 years old. I was called to serve in the branch presidency. I was a man who knew where he was going. I was an up-and-coming young professional. I dressed like a young lawyer. I had my briefcase, I had my three-piece suit. It was, a lot of ways, pathetic. But at the time, I thought it was really cool. So I get that going on. Our kids come along. I loved them the best I could. Brad and Kathy, bless their hearts. But I didn't know a lot of stuff. It never occurred to me I didn't know stuff. I thought I had it all together. My wife, as you will learn later, put up with a bunch of my crap that she shouldn't have. But like I said, I did the best I could. When I was early 30s, I started exploring. I had a friend who started introducing me to some of these things about introspection and about exploration, about confrontation. And I started. And there was one night that epitomizes what the journey of the embrace was all about for me. I was well into the exploration. I was making some changes in my life. And I woke up in the middle of the night. And Cindy was a nurse, and she was at the emergency room having a night shift. So I was there in bed alone. And I was just, sometimes I'd wake up and I'd start thinking about things. And a thought came to me, and it was a weird thought. And I just, that's crazy. And I went on thinking about things, and a thought came to me again. And I thought, I don't know any. And I started thinking about other things. And the third time the thought came. And I thought to myself, the only one I know is angel friends from my turn on earth. And the thought was, sing yourself a lullaby. And I thought, okay. So I started singing, you came from a land of all. And I started crying. And I continued to try to sing, but you can't sing when you cry, and so I kind of whispered it, and I cried some more. And after it was done, I cried some more, and then I went to sleep. Well, in the morning, I was in shaving when Cindy came home, and we greeted each other, and I said, kind of a weird, strange thing happened, interesting thing happened last night. She said, oh, what? And I rehearsed to her what had happened. And after I explained to her, she just kind of looked at me. And I said, well, what do you think? And she says, well, that's nice. And I said, no, really, what do you think? She says, I think it's kind of weird. And I said, I think it's kind of weird too. But this is what I think is weird. This was the first time that I could remember in my 30 plus years of life that I had ever verbally expressed affection and compassion and love for myself. And I cannot tell you the bajillions of times that I had castigated myself, that I had called myself names, that I had sworn at myself, that I had said, you know, stupid, this, you know, crap, this and that. I mean, how many times has that occurred? And it was like, yeah. So that kind of illustrates this, what happens on some level when, and I believe it was compassion. Compassion turned the key. Something changed within me that allowed me to start accepting myself and stop hiding from myself and stop pretending that I was certain kinds of things when when in reality, I wasn't. And I think even deeper reality, I didn't want to be. Now, that's the first section. Do you have any questions or comments in relationship to clarifications? Or is it, like I say, hopefully as we go along, it'll get a little tighter. And if you wouldn't mind, come up and... Because they have a big, rightly so, about hearing the most interesting parts of the conversation.
Do you find a correlation between children who are gifted or talented or achievers and this lack of really knowing their true self? Is it more likely for them than other children who are just average?
Good question, and I don't have a good response for it. I would guess that gifted children do struggle more or have to hide more, depending on the environment, if it's nurtured or not. I think if it's nurtured, they're blessed. If it's not nurtured, if they're just, once again, kind of geeky in relationship to the peers, it's even harder. So here's the ego, who think it's running the show, but it's really not. It hides. The balance of masculine and feminine energy can be really skewed and really mess us up. The shadow is a big part of who we pretend not who we are. And I might say at this point too, because I think this is important, the ego, I believe, is the natural man and woman. It is the fallen part of ourselves that likes to pretend that nothing is wrong. I'm doing just fine all by myself. It's the part that nurtures the pride. It's the part that nurtures the grandiosity. It's the part that just is, just once again, very, very pathetic when you see it in its context. Now, marriage. The marital, there's no other word for it, as far as I'm concerned, than the word that Joseph Campbell uses. He calls marriage an ordeal. Because what happens is that if you piss me off, I don't have to live with you. And I can think you're a jerk. Pet peeves I can deal with from afar with other people. At work, at church, whatever. But when I marry someone, we are held captive by that other person. And that captiveness can really be a blessing in disguise if we're willing to experience the ordeal of what it is. So, what happens then in marriage is this whole thing becomes a little more complicated. The ego has to still project the parts of us that are unaccepted. It's one thing to project them out on you as people in my life. It's another thing to project them out on my spouse and say, you know, if it wasn't for that, if it wasn't for you, we'd be so much happier. If you just grow up, if you just stop acting that way, if you just start doing what I want you to do, we'd be so much happier. So when that doesn't happen, it creates what Robert Firestone calls emotional gridlock. Emotional gridlock is when we don't know what to do. We're enmeshed. We can't pull out. We just keep butting our heads. And who hasn't had the experience of being married for a certain amount, probably 2 years, and more, we end up arguing about the same kinds of things over and over and over and over again. The same terrain is covered over and over and over again, and it gets so boring and it gets so frustrating, and yet nobody can do anything about it. The ego likes to think it's in charge. The ego likes to think it can fix everything, but in reality, it's part of the problem, a big part of the problem. When I first learned about projection, projecting our weaknesses, I thought, okay, if there's something true to this, I should be able to see it on a cultural level. It not only happens individually in our marriages, but it happens on a cultural level. So what happens is I ask some of my friends. What irritates you about the other gender? I ask my women, female friends, what irritates you about men? And I went to my men friends and I said, what irritates you about women? Just generally, nothing specifically, but just as a gender. Well, see if these at all sound familiar. I collected four of them. He never listens to me. He only wants one thing. He is insensitive and selfish, and he's emotionally shut down. Now, I haven't done a very good job of explaining projection, but hopefully good enough that it makes sense. If there are things that irritate me about you women, and there are things that, if I were a woman, irritate me about you men, it really should be a reflection of what's going on some level, as a group. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the projection, and then I'm going to give you the part that is disowned in each of the genders in responding to each of these complaints. So does this make sense? He never listens to me. You never listen to your own heart. He only wants one thing. Right. It's the one thing that you can't want if you remain a good girl. He is insensitive and selfish. Right. And you ignore your own self in the hopes of pleasing others. He's emotionally shut down. Yeah. Maybe you have become lost and depressed in your own life. Now the men, their complaints were, she overreacts, she is manipulative, she is always trying to change me, and she talks too much. Now, this projection may look something like this. She overreacts. Yes, she overreacts because you're always underreacting, like nothing is a big deal. She is manipulative. Well, for somebody who has all the power, you don't have to worry about playing those kinds of games. She is always trying to change me. Yeah. Why? Well, because once again, our pride and our power, we don't have to worry about change. And she talks too much. Yeah, maybe because we're disconnected from our own bodies and can't engage in small talk. If these things are true, and I believe they are, maybe our complaints about our spouse may be indications of disowned parts of ourselves. And if we paid attention to those major complaints, we could learn something about ourselves. I think also our complaints are disguised parts of ourselves that we need fulfilled. But I don't know how fair it is to expect another human being to meet psychological needs from our own childhoods that they're incapable of meeting. And in our own lives, if we don't awaken to that. So I think a good exercise, and Harville Hendrix in his book, Getting the Love That You Want, which I highly recommend, especially to any newly married and even old married couples, explore what those pet peeves are. Explore what those unmet needs are. Because it is a confrontation, a spiritual journey, once again, into your own heart, into your own history. And maybe what happened to you as a child. And probably, I think, one of the most difficult things to do, I know with college-age students, because they're in the midst of denial, I used to think that what I taught in college was age-inappropriate. I really should have 45-year-olds in my classes, not, you know, 20-year-olds. Because the kinds of things that 45-year-olds confront in their lives, it's like they've lived life long enough to realize that, I guess the ego's not in charge. I guess there's other stuff going on in my life that I don't get. And that can be very, very insightful when I think you've had enough life experience that that starts to open up to you. Here is a statement from The Family Crucible by Napier and Whitaker. Counselors that are involved in a real marriage, a family counseling situation. And I think it catches this intermeshed, intertwined projection. Talking about a couple, He says, quote, "When I spoke to them, I had a sense of their problem as a couple. I could see the collective pain, the collusive, interlocked, and entrapping patterns, the overarching stress that engulfed them both. They remained symbiotically entangled, their perception of their marriage often violently distorted by their mutual and pervasive insecurities and by the psychological shadows of their separate family histories. When they began now to yell at each other, it was because each of them actually felt that the other person constituted a locked door that excluded them from their own personhood. They still experienced the door to freedom and happiness as being in the other, not the self. Neither had dared cross that definitive threshold which marked entry to the exploration of the self." One of the things that I used to make a big deal about in dating marriage prep and marriage classes, I said, if you want to get ready for marriage, get older. And the more preparation that you can do with self-exploration, the better you will be prepared for marriage. And once they got married in my parenting classes, they said, you want to be a better parent? Then you better start exploring your own childhood and stuff that you've hidden from. Because that stuff is going to leak out all over your children. And you may have thought that you had the most wonderful childhood in the world. And it's like, well, we can wait and see what happens in relationship to your children, because that's where the truth will be told. If one is able to explore the self, if one is able to embrace that self, I will promise you, you will then be able to do it with another human being. If you can look past your own shadow, if you can learn to embrace that, if you can see yourself as the wounded, underbelly person that we all are, once you do that with yourself, that will enable you to embrace another human being, your marital partner specifically. I think even in romance, in long-term relationships, it is so much easier to leave the relationship than it is to confront some of this stuff. It's scary stuff. How are we doing for time?
We've got 20 minutes.
Okay. That will do. One other thing. I need to introduce this idea. It's a fantasy bond. Fantasy bond is a term coined by Robert Firestone in his book Compassionate Child Rearing, and he talks about in his marriage books, and once again, highly recommend it. The fantasy bond is simply this. It's a relationship role play. What do I do in life if I don't know who I am? The best I can do is role play. You give me a script, I can enter that script with you. Ask me to play along, give me enough experiences, I'll be able to play along with you. You may not know who I really am, because I'll keep that hidden, because I don't know how to expose it. But once I expose it to myself, and once I stop running from myself, and really, this is where the metaphorical dark cave comes into the dragon. It really is like confronting the dark cave, and something bad is going to happen to you. Your old brain survival kicks in, and it scares you to death. You confront it, and some good things happen. Once you do that, then, in yourself, you can do it with your marriage partner. And if you never do it with yourself, I believe a lot of marriage couples get stuck in fantasy bonds. Fantasy bonds are just, once again, what we should do. I'll give you a couple quick examples. I'll use Cammy as an example. I'm her father, she's my daughter. I say, Cammy, you will respect me. Okay? Cammy, you understand that? So Cammy says to herself, fine, I'll respect you. So she plays along with me. And I come in, I want to talk to you about something. She'll give me the time of day, and she'll roll her eyes after I leave. But it pleases me. I mean, I'm being respected, right? I can't enter into an intimate relationship with her because I'm cut off from it myself. I'm not going to listen to her feelings because I can't even listen to my own. So in marriage, we're supposed to love each other, right, Cindy? I mean, that's what this whole temple marriage, marriage for eternity is all about. We're supposed to love each other. So there are certain loving relationships and certain loving behaviors that people do. And we learned that growing up. So if I engage in that behavior and you engage in that behavior, everything is typically fine. But what happens when problems start, as they always do, and compound, and we become this emotionally gridlocked couple? Then it's like, what do? If I have never confronted myself, if I have not embraced myself, then I'm stuck with nothing better than a fantasy bond. I don't know what to do, and I cannot talk about it, because I am scared to death and I am ashamed. I think it's fascinating. So many Mormons cannot talk about divorce. But we will fantasize about what would happen if they died. What happened if she didn't come home from that conference, or he doesn't come home from that conference, or he just gets in the car? Well, you can't talk about that stuff. Even in a context of, you know, I think one of the most healthiest things we could do, it would be to just get together as married people and talk about really what's going on. How are we feeling? But it would scare us to death. It would threaten our marriages. Because here's the scary part about fantasy bonds. Fantasy bonds will threaten the destruction of your marriage when you confront it. And most people can't deal with it. Because it feels so tenuous as it is. It's easier just to go along playing the role, the relationship role play. And then we lose each other over the years and we wonder, what's happened? Well, what's happened is we never knew ourselves. And knowing ourselves lead to... a process called differentiation. And differentiation is simply this. It's like, I'm not you, I'm me. And if I can figure out what's going on in my own life, I can then share that with you. And that's what intimacy is. If you want a good definition of intimacy, it's the sharing of feelings, plain and simple. It's not sexual, it's not wrong, it's just sharing feelings. If you're going to be intimate with somebody, if you can share feelings, that's what intimacy is. But in romantic cultures, the sharing of feelings only are positive ones. But no, real intimacy requires negative ones too. The cold pricklies, along with the warm fuzzies. So you have to be able to share that in a marriage. If I have not dealt with my own energies and my wife starts to get angry, I'm going to want her shut her down. Don't talk to me that way. Her anger may scare me. Because I've never dealt with it myself. Once again, this whole thing, once I start to embrace myself, once I confront my own shadow, I can then successfully start to allow another person to be who they are. They don't have to be a certain way for me. They don't have to act a certain way. I can learn to accept them the way that they are because I have learned to accept myself, and compassion is the key. Without compassion, all of this stuff is just ego. And it'll take you, you know, a little ways, but it won't take you where you need to go. Okay, story to illustrate. Cindy and I were married probably 5, 6, 7 years. I don't know, we were down in Provo, I was doing some postdoctoral work. We had Brad and Cammie, they were little, and we got into an argument. Neither one of us remember what the argument was about, but it got pretty intense, got pretty turbulent. Cindy leaves with the two kids. She goes to Salt Lake, visits her grandma, and she decides that day that she, if she would have had the money, would have gone back to Minnesota to her parents just to get away from me. Well, she comes back without having gone to Minnesota, just coming back because she didn't have the money. And she shares with me, and I don't know if it was that night or the next day or the next week, that she was thinking those thoughts. This is what I said to her. I said, that's fine, but if you ever do, don't bother coming back. That is so typical of my male, stupid ego. That masculine part of myself wanted to let her know that I was not going to, you know, put up with that. As I confronted myself over the years, I was able to readjust my own masculine energies, embrace the feminine stuff without being embarrassed, and dealt with my ego and my own shadow, realizing that I was, when all was said and done, a jerk in a lot of ways. And it was like, and that was okay. Because accepting that about myself, I would say 95% of the energy released. And I didn't have to act like I was always in control, like I always knew. Cindy is 4 years younger than me, about a foot smaller than me, And we could go into that psychologically, but just suffice it to say that I always thought that I was the mature one, that I was the educated one, that I was the experienced one. And Cindy, bless her heart, just patiently waited until I started to grow up. And not to say that she didn't need to grow up too, but she's on her own journey. And as I've gone on my journey, I haven't tried to proselyte Cindy. She's seen what it's done, and she's been kind of interested as the books have been around the house, and I've engaged her in conversations that may have, you know, triggered certain things. But it's like, yeah, and Cindy is, bless her heart, is on her own journey, and we're not on the same timetable, and we don't need to be. But the mutual respect that comes from awakening and embracing and coming out of the cultural slumber is a wonderful blessing in lives and in marriages. The last area is the divine. But before we go to the divine, are there any questions or clarifications or that anybody wants to ask or make? Okay, the last one is probably the most disjointed at all because it's a journey that I'm still on. And but I'll share with you what I can. I really do believe that this union with the divine is nothing more nor less than falling in love. And the same process that it took in my own life to fall in love with who I was, shadow, darkness and all, the same dynamics of falling in love with Cindy, surrendering my ego dominance, rebalancing the energies, the feminine, masculine energies, and owning my shadow, not projecting it on him anymore, not projecting it upon Cindy, not blaming Cindy for the problem, but understanding the problem resides in me. This is where it's at. It's the same thing that takes place with God. Anias Nin said this: we see others not as we are, but as they are, but as we are. We see others not as they are, but as we are. And most of us, as I remember growing up, I prayed to an old male god with a white beard and white hair, and sometimes he was mean. And so he was very demanding. And he was very demanding at the time of my life that I was very demanding myself and very judgmental. And I hid from God, the same way I hid from myself and other people. As we start to, challenge some of those things, as we start to embrace the shadow instead of projecting it upon God, and in the context of this paper, I had to redefine the term shadow when I apply it to God. And I'll explain that in just a minute. I think we are set up by our culture. I think this is a fallen, warped, skewed culture that we live in, and that a lot of the wounding comes as we learn to accommodate it to it. And it's like, it becomes pretty normal then. Marcus Borg, in his book, says, "The God We Never Knew," writes this: "Tell me your image of God, and I'll tell you about your theology." Now, we as Mormons worship an all-male God. Marcus Borg, I would guess then, would suggest this about our theology: that we value qualities like organization, like power, like control, like logic, like position, like title, like authority, like regulations, like policy, like laws, like order, like leadership, etc., etc. It's all highly valued in a masculine theology that worships a male God. That in itself sets up a skewed, notion. Because if we see God as masculine, then we don't see any of the feminine qualities. The same way in myself and the same way in our marriage. You know what it's like to have this big man here calling all the shots in this submissive, dependent female? Is that a healthy marriage? No, but according to our culture, it's a marriage based upon division of role and could be very effective, could be very productive as they each do their own thing. But I'm willing to bet there's very little intimacy. There's very little compassion. There's just expectation and kind of a familiarity and very happy with it as far as we men are concerned, because we happen to get the long end of the stick. The scariest thing about the imbalance that occurs within our own theology is that most men see nothing wrong with it. Like, this is the way that it should be. No problem there. Walter Wink, in his book, The Powers That Be, two concepts that I really find fascinating. Once again, recommend that book if you ever get a chance to read that. The Powers That Be. He said, we're all impacted by the powers that be. And the powers that be, he relates to whether you're in a family, institution, business, church, country, whatever the case may be. The people in that organization or in that institution create a spirit, a frequency of spirit. And it takes on a life of its own. And that spirit then continues to function independent of the personalities in those organizations and in that family or in that marriage. So you can go into some families and they'll have a very kind of hostile, kind of scary, suppressed feeling. It's pretty tough to, and it's like, oh, parents seem like pretty normal people. And marriage is the same thing, and church is the same thing, and business is the same thing. And he says, he makes this point about, he says, they're evil. These powers that be are evil. And he says, not in some deprived way, but simply in the fact that they're fallen and they need to be healed. These powers need to be healed. He talks about another concept, the myth of redemptive violence. See if this makes sense. He believes that this myth is based upon might equals right. If you have the power, you can be redeemed. You get your way if you have the power. Might makes right. Whoever has the gold rules makes the rules. There's a lot of different ways to say it. But the idea simply is that, and don't we learn it as children to get your own way? As a parent, you just apply more power and apply more power to get your own way. And don't women often learn that from the men in their life? That if you don't act a certain way, then we'll exert our power and punish you or leave you, abandon you, find another woman who will do what we want. Businesses, church, you act a certain way or you're going to experience punishment. And this myth of redemptive violence, I believe, creates a particularly powerful, potent, masculine paradigm that's almost impossible to challenge. It reminds me of a statement that I collected in graduate school down at BYU. It was right at the time when I was confronting this idea that being taught maybe God is masculine and feminine. Maybe there is this duality to God. This is the statement. See if it resonates with you at all. Quote, men created the establishment for themselves, and ever since they have been running it. Men organize the wars, decide the laws, they proclaim religion, control the money, define the language, and write the literature, and then they congratulate themselves and call it God-given. Close quote. That's the nature of this masculine paradigm. The powers that be, that govern our realities, that govern our logic, that govern our paradigms, and this redemptive violence, which is dishonest and a myth. But the fact is that if you've got the power, you will be saved. I'm not talking about an eternal sense, but just in the day-to-day, you get what you want. And, what more could you ask for than that? One of my most spiritual experiences occurred probably 15, 16 years ago. I participated in an Apache healing sweat lodge. I cannot tell you, I cannot tell you what a spiritual time that was. Being overwhelmed by the heat, number one. Having to lie down and trying to get cooler air close to Mother Earth and hearing the people go around and pray. Nothing like we hear at church. And when my time came to pray, I prayed a prayer that was very inspirational to me and nothing like I'd ever offered before in my life. It was a sweet, sweet thing. Okay, set that aside. I also remember when I was at the Ricks College and I was struggling with my own integrity, spiritual and otherwise. Did I believe that a feminine God existed? And I remember thinking, if I do, and I did, then I shouldn't be ashamed to pray to her. And in my family, in my home, I would often start our prayers, our Heavenly Father and Mother. But this was at a department meeting. In the family, department family, I thought, what better place than the department of family at an LDS institution than to acknowledge. And I didn't pray directly to Heavenly Mother, I just included her, our Heavenly Father and Mother, and I offered the department prayer. Well, it didn't take long. That same afternoon, I paid a price for my integrity. The academic vice president of the college had been made aware of the situation, I'm sure, by a concerned faculty member for my salvation. But I remember feeling, God bless me for having the courage at least to do it. I think, and I've got to wrap this up in 3 minutes, and I have one more section to read, and I'm reading it because I can't say it any better than I wrote it. See if this makes sense to you, because it's an idea that has just been fussing with me. I think this ego is so grandiose, and I think what has happened within the context of the gospel of Christ, I think the church and the gospel now have been egoized to a point that it just appeals to us. Think about the idea of becoming gods, principalities and powers. Oh, that's wonderful. That just thrills me. It thrills my little ego. And I think there's something sad about that. Because if I understand Eckhart Tolle in his book, The New Earth, he's suggesting that true spirituality is an absence of ego. And I find it fascinating in this Western culture, we don't talk about wisdom. In the Eastern culture, talks about wisdom a lot. And I'm thinking, what's the nature of wisdom in relationship to ego? I'm thinking, ego is anything but wisdom. It's power. It's authority. It's grandiosity. And the absence of ego then leads to, maybe some wisdom. I think it's fascinating to see the scripture refer to wisdom in the feminine. Well, okay, so here's the punchline. There's a union that needs to occur on our hearts, in our marriages, and with God. And all that has to do was with this owning the shadow, balancing the energies in our hearts, in our marriages, and in the divine, for that to occur. Now, at the end of my paper, I have these notes. I'm going to read you the last note of my paper. I think it's pretty obvious that the implications of becoming one carry sexual overtones. And I'm talking about becoming one with God. The scriptures are replete with metaphorical references to virgins, harlots, whoredoms, brides, bridegrooms, and such. I know that not everyone will agree with me, but I think the sexual connection is interesting nevertheless. What if the metaphorical interior mating of the soul was required of our feminine and masculine energies before a whole, complete, mature human being could be metaphorically and spiritually conceived? And what if the counsel given to married couples to become one flesh was simply a descriptive metaphor for what happens when the man and woman join together as a new spiritual creature in the image of God? This oneness becomes literal for the child born of that union, and metaphorically for their own potential oneness. And what are the implications of us becoming one with God, joining and mating with the divine principles in ways that are described by Christ as becoming one with them, male and female? Then shall they be gods. Doesn't the joy and pleasure of physical union reflect in some way the spiritual rapture of union and becoming one with the divine? By ignoring the divine feminine principle, men have created a dilemma for themselves in creating an all-male godhead to worship. Consequently, when the spiritual union of worship, of which the sexual union is symbolic, is invited, males tend to withdraw into the intellectual world of ego. This withdrawal into ego may help deal with the unconscious discomfort of union with the same gendered god. Maybe that explains the excessively sterile, controlled, and intellectual worship experiences that are so common in our churches today. Maybe in some Freudian way, the male-dominated culture of the religious West has displaced its unconscious fear and anxiety about becoming one with the male god unto the gays. This is especially provocative in a culture ripe in homophobia. Unfortunately, the gays may have to suffer the projected hostility of male egos who remain asleep to their own unbalanced self-contempt and fear of rejected feminine energies. This, while the rest of us in the heterosexual population suffer the imbalance caused by the rejection of the divine feminine principle in our worship of God. Thank you.